Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The scene was familiar, as was the speaker, Ben Bernanke, on Capitol Hill, again, talking about the economy, again. The message was a little bit different this time, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear conversations with poets about the economy, music, cooking, and more at AmericanPublicMedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 5th of May. Great to have you here. But never mind what the calendar says, because on Capitol Hill today, it was Groundhog Day for all those Washington policy types. The chairman of the Federal Reserve made a repeat appearance before the Joint Economic Committee. But you had to listen pretty closely to hear what Ben Bernanke was actually saying. Because in between the lines about the economy getting better by the end of the year was a carefully worded reality check. Even when the economy does pick up, he said, things aren't going to be just like they used to. From Washington Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
Ben Bernanke told members of Congress this morning the recession is losing steam.
We continue to expect economic activity to bottom out, then to turn up later this year.
The Fed chairman said he saw some glimmers of hope in recent economic data, signs that American consumers might start spending again soon.
In coming months, household spending power will be boosted by the fiscal stimulus program, and we have seen some improvement in consumer sentiment.
And for the last few months, Wall Street certainly acted as if the worst was already over. Yesterday, for a brief moment, the S&P 500 was actually up for the year. Simon Johnson at MIT agrees the economy is no longer in free fall, but
I'm not sure we really turned the corner in any sustainable fashion.
More than 500,000 people are getting laid off every month. Unemployment seems likely to push past 10%. Housing prices are still falling and credit markets are tight. Johnson says after the government stimulus works its way through the economy, he's not sure where new economic growth will come from.
Where do we see expansion? And of course, what's driving that? Is it about investment? Is it about consumer spending?
The answers aren't obvious. Peter Schiff at Euro-Pacific Capital says policymakers in Washington are hoping consumer spending drives a recovery.
What they're trying to do is encourage Americans to do exactly what they did that helped create the problem. They want Americans going out and buying more things that they can't afford.
But Schiff believes a recovery like that won't last. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Tune in Friday to find out exactly how consumer spending is going to shape up over the next month or so. We're going to get the April unemployment report Friday morning. Today, though, is Cinco de Mayo. It's a Mexican holiday that commemorates the 1862 victory over French troops at the Battle of Puebla. Translated north of the border, it means a lot of people in this country are going to be eating guacamole and drinking margaritas or Mexican beer today. In Mexico, though, there won't be any public celebrations due to the swine flu outbreak. But tomorrow, the government is going to let businesses and restaurants reopen, although it won't quite be business as usual. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Mexico City's Café Tacuba is getting ready to reopen tomorrow. A crew is scrubbing the walls and floors. Fresh food has begun to arrive. But accountant Magdalena Flores says Wednesday will not be business as usual. Though restaurants can reopen, the government has imposed strict measures on employees to contain the swine flu.
The waitress and the people in the restaurant must use face masks. We have to use latex gloves, and the distance between the tables must be more than 2 meters.
That's more than 6 feet between tables. Flores says that measure cuts the restaurant's 150-person capacity by half.
It's a 50% reopening. We don't need all the employees. We don't need all the resources to attend the few people we are expecting.
Officials say the flu outbreak has already cost Mexico's economy more than $2 billion, up to 0.5% of GDP. That's a huge hit to a country already struggling with declining exports, reduced oil income, and a drug war at the border. Yet it could have been much worse. Lee Tabluski directs Project Mexico at the Institute of the Americas.
Mexico's government dealt with the crisis in an amazingly effective way. They've shown that their government can mobilize under some challenging circumstances, and I think Mexico has dodged a bullet here, and we'll see a recovery.
The Mexican government has pledged $1.3 billion to jumpstart small businesses and tourism. Guy Santoro could use the help. He's executive chef of the Hotel Intercontinental Presidente in Mexico City. The hotel's seven restaurants normally bring in $3 million a month, but April was down by 60%, and May is looking grim. Santoro says he's being pressured by the hotel owners to cut costs and spending. He says that means a complete reorganization of the kitchens. And it means some of his 400 employees will have to be let go. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
U.S. television networks are gearing up for their annual ritual of advertising excess known as the upfronts. That's when they trot out next season's show schedule to entice ad buyers to buy. NBC is pinning its hopes on Jay Leno as he moves from late night to 10 p.m., and it's hinting at an extra incentive to lure those ad dollars, as Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports.
Remember back in TV's heyday? Sometimes Johnny Carson would tell you exactly what to buy right in the middle of his show.
Really, I'd like to stop kidding around right now and get down to the business at hand, which, of course, is the 1972 Budweiser campaign.
Well, those days could be coming back. Yesterday in New York, NBC's Mike Pilot suggested Carson's heir, Jay Leno, isn't afraid to, quote, experiment with live commercials on his new primetime show. That's a purposely vague word, experiment, but Marissa Gluck of Radar Research says she wouldn't be surprised if Leno does end up appearing in live ads.
NBC is in fourth place. NBC doesn't have a single show in the top 10. So I think that there's a level of desperation there.
To be clear, Leno already features live ads on his current show. He just doesn't directly participate, leaving the huckster duties to others like announcer John Melendez. According to USC marketing professor Kenneth Wilbur, NBC would be wise to step up its live ads in the age of TiVo.
NBC's audience is more tech savvy. They have higher rates of digital video recorder usage than the other networks. So by putting Jay Leno directly into the advertisements, it lowers the probability that viewers will fast forward past them.
The question, of course, is whether Leno would actually do it. NBC is keeping the picture murky, saying only they're in, quote, conversations about how to structure advertising on what could be the cash cow they've been lacking. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Wall Street was mostly careful today, you could say. Not a whole lot of movement. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. At the White House today, President Obama met with congressional Democrats to talk about global warming legislation. Leaders have said they want to get a bill passed by the end of the year. But before that can happen, they'll have to get the rest of the Democratic caucus to come to an agreement. Because where a given lawmaker stands on how to control greenhouse gases depends largely on where they're from. And as Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, how they feel about giving something away for free.
Capping greenhouse gas emissions is the central idea in this year's global warming legislation. Regulators would lower that cap over time. Polluters would then have to either clean up or trade with cleaner companies for the right to pollute. But Congress has a choice: to give those carbon allowances away or make emitters pay. Yale's William Nordhaus says economically it's a no-brainer. A license to pollute is a valuable commodity.
And we shouldn't give it away, just as we don't give away outer continental shelf oil, we don't give away the airways, we shouldn't give away the rights to emit CO2.
President Obama's budget director told Congress cap-and-trade handouts would amount to the largest corporate welfare program in U.S. history. And Obama campaigned on auctioning off 100% of the permits. He wants to use the proceeds to fund a middle-class tax cut and clean energy R&D. One problem, though, politicians from coal and oil states are balking.
I have five refineries in my district and a lot of chemical plants, and even a middle-class tax cut to someone who doesn't have a job doesn't help.
That's House Democrat Gene Green of Texas. He's referring to industries that complain that carbon permits simply increase their costs and put them at a disadvantage to foreign competitors. Refiners are pushing Congress to get 30% of their carbon permits free. Electric utilities want 40%. Today, Henry Waxman, chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, said President Obama will give lawmakers wide latitude to strike a deal. David Doniger at the Natural Resources Defense Council is wary.
You just can't give power generators, a lot of free allowances, no strings attached, to just end up with huge windfall.
Doniger points to Europe as an example. It gave away lots of free carbon allowances. Utilities there pocketed billions by raising electricity rates anyway and selling off excess permits. Johns Hopkins professor Scott Barrett says we shouldn't repeat the EU's biggest mistake, giving out too many permits.
And what that means is that there's too much of the stuff around, and therefore the price at which these permits are traded was too low. And because the price was too low, very little was done to reduce emissions.
And reducing emissions, says Barrett, is the whole point of cap and trade in the first place. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Among the most brilliant marketing moves ever has to be the one that convinced us to spend $4 for a cup of coffee that costs a company maybe, I don't know, 30 cents, half a buck to make. Seen in that light, the news today that McDonald's is going to spend $100 million promoting its specialty coffees makes some sense. Mochas, cappuccinos, and lattes on sale now at McCafés around the country, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Here's one of the ads from the new campaign.
With McDonald's McCafe, a better day is possible. Introducing hotter iced mocha.
With ads like that, McDonald's is hoping to bring in at least $100,000 per store in premium coffee sales. That's about $1 billion a year, says analyst Steve West of Stifel Nicolaus.
You cannot underestimate the might of McDonald's marketing.
West says Starbucks has shown that Americans can be convinced to trade up in the coffee market. In fact, he says people who buy regular coffee are a dying breed.
The younger generations tend to drink specialty coffee, and so McDonald's is really just going after that big category out there. There's a lot of money and a lot of profit in that category.
So I've brought our intern Raphael Cohen into the studio with me for a quick taste test here, and we've got one McDonald's latte and one Starbucks latte. They're both in the same cup, so I can't tell which one is which, and I'm going to taste this first one. A lot more froth there. It tastes like a good strong latte. And this one, no froth, and oh my God, Raphael, this is sweet.
What do you think, Jeremy?
I'm going to have to say that the super sweet one is from McDonald's.
Bingo.
All right. Add sugar and everybody will buy it. There we go. Thanks, Raphael.
No problem.
And in case you were wondering, it took 1 minute and 5 seconds for a barista to make the Starbucks latte. The slightly cheaper McDonald's latte was made by a machine in 44 seconds. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
I don't know if you saw the video today, but President Obama and Vice President Biden went out to eat for their weekly lunch date today, a burger joint in Northern Virginia. We don't really get a lunch break here, what with getting the program on the air and all. So last week after work, some of us decided to grab a burger not far from my house at a local chain called In-N-Out Burger. Hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. I would like a cheeseburger, animal style, fries, and a root beer.
Okay.
And my friend here?
I'll have a grilled cheese, animal style, and a Diet Coke.
All right, it'll be 8:43, please.
My lunch date was Stacey Perman. She writes for Business Week magazine, and she's got a new book about In-N-Out. The company is privately held, relatively small, just a couple of hundred stores in four states, all out west. But it is something of a cultural marker. The menu's pretty simple: burgers, fries, sodas, and shakes. Perman points out, though, that you can mix it up, like that animal-style burger mustard cooked into the meat with pickles and grilled onions.
Something that a lot of people don't know about is the animal-style French fries. You might have to go to food rehab afterwards. It's not a healthy choice.
But broken into parts, the ingredients, Perman says, are as healthy as you're going to get for fast food.
They have their own butcher line. They make sure their beef patties are fresh. They make them themselves and deliver them to the stores. They bake their own buns. The fries are hand-cut, and everything's made to order. They also treat their employees incredibly well. If you're a part-time worker today, you make $10 an hour.
Wow.
And store managers that meet their goals, the company takes them on first-class trips abroad to Europe, Caribbean cruises. They're very generous.
I'm definitely in the wrong line of work. Tell me about the couple that started this chain.
That would be Harry and Esther Snyder. She was the daughter and granddaughter of coal miners, and he was the son of Dutch immigrants that didn't, you know, make a lot of money during their lives. And he was the classic entrepreneur. At the time when they started In-N-Out in 1948 in Baldwin Park, California, that was the time of the car hops and the big drive-ins and the kitschy architecture. But the Snyders didn't have a lot of money, so they only had a very small plot of land with no indoor seating even. So Harry was an electronics enthusiast, and he came up with this two-way speakerphone, which is basically the prototype for what became today's drive-through.
There is a very strong corporate culture here, too. I mean, they're very set in their ways and how they do things and what they want this store to be.
Definitely. That started from the very beginning with the Snyders. Their business philosophy was based on three words: quality, cleanliness, and service.
How was everything, guys?
It was delicious, as always.
Good.
Thank you.
Let me get rid of that. Are you all good?
You know, I'm going to pick at the fries for a while. Thanks.
Cool. All right.
I mean, how many fast food restaurants do you know the wait staff comes to you and sees if you need anything and wants to clean up after you?
That's a good point. How involved were the Snyders once this place got big?
Micromanagers, particularly Harry. I mean, in the beginning, he actually would go to his meat purveyor, stand over him, and watch him cut up the beef to make sure he got what he ordered. And Esther, until her, you know, dying days, you know, she would have her driver take her to the drive-thrus, wouldn't, you know, announce herself, order a burger, sit in the parking lot, take it apart, make sure it was constructed correctly. I mean, she was really involved.
You know, when I moved out here, I discovered two things that you couldn't get back east. One was Trader Joe's, which you now can. The other one is In-N-Out Burgers. For those guys in New York and on the East Coast who are, you know, whose mouths are watering right now at the prospect of a hamburger animal style, what are the prospects for more expansion to other parts of the country and the world?
Well, here's the thing. They've expanded slowly for a few reasons. One is the fact that, as I said, they have butchers that create the beef. They have these commissaries. They don't open a store outside of a 500-mile radius from one of these commissaries so that they can deliver the fresh goods on a daily basis. They could go to New York, but let's put it this way. They opened their fourth state, Utah, 60 years after opening. So that's not, you know, anybody's Sherman's march on Atlanta by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, Stacey Perman, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, colleges stripping down to attract students.
What they wanted was the academic experience. What they were less interested in were things like fitness centers and food courts.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial shed 16 points today, about 0.2%, closed at 8,410. The NASDAQ dropped 9 points, more than 0.5% to finish at 1,754. The S&P 500 slid 3 points. That is just about 0.4%, ended the day at 903. D.R. Horton, the nation's largest home builder, saw shares tumble nearly 8.5% today after announcing a quarterly loss of more than $100 million. Drugstore operator CVS Caremark needed some aspirin after news of its own quarterly loss. Stock slid about 0.75%, but not all investors were disappointed. Weyerhaeuser beat Wall Street expectations in the first quarter, and that helped drive shares up 2%. Executives at Molson Coors no doubt cracked a cold one today. Positive earnings pushed shares of the brewing company up 9.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.16%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on regulating institutions considered too big to fail. The House Committee looks at fraud and loan modification and foreclosure rescues and how to prevent it. And it's perhaps not a time to get on the scale. Tomorrow, some folks observe International No Diet Day. Ditch the obsessions in favor of a healthy body image. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to do one thing at a time in our letter segment today. That would make Winifred Gallagher happy. We talked to her a couple of weeks ago about her new book, Wrapped, how we're not paying enough attention to what we're doing at any given moment, and that being able to multitask is a total myth. A lot of you, like David Nassetti of Turlock, California, agreed.
If you actually pay attention to what you're focusing on throughout the day, I believe you'll find she's more correct than you'd care to admit.
Linda Tonner from Stewartstown, Pennsylvania, wrote to say exactly the opposite, that sometimes you just have to do two things at once and do them well.
I don't know if this author ever had a baby, since if she had, she would know that not only is multitasking possible, but absolutely essential.
Commentator Gustavo Arellano offered some thoughts about the American dream last week, how he thinks his immigrant parents are going to fare better during this recession than he will.
My parents and their amigos came from an existence of nothing, an existence in which the sword of poverty dangled above families daily, teaching them to always prepare for the worst. My amigos and I, spoiled on the Reagan-era notion of faith in money, stand at the edge of economic despair.
Russ Waddell from the great state of Virginia doesn't see it that way.
I would suspect that Ariana's situation closely mirrors that of his age cohort. I'm not convinced that his parents' ethnic background matters at all.
We covered pension plans a few weeks ago and how more of them are going bust. Right after that story, we had one about soup kitchens running out of food. Robert Mercer from Yardley, PA, caught the irony.
Without solid pension plans, we can assure that the nonprofits will continue to have ample clients.
I talked to Michelle Leader from the website footnoted.org last week about the perks a lot of big corporate executives get, company helicopters, that kind of thing. Michelle pointed out that boards of directors at these companies tend not to rein in that kind of spending, to which Justin Harrison from Northport, Alabama, offered this.
I can't help but wonder how many of the members of these boards have enjoyed similar perks in their own careers. Why would they set a precedent by denying such benefits and then run the risk of losing them themselves or appearing hypocritical?
Now for easily the most commented upon story of the week, a piece from Dan Gratch about companies packaging human hair for use as garden fertilizer. A slew of you wrote to say you're already doing that or that your dad's been gardening that way for years. But Dan noted that a company that markets the hair mats, as they're called, are worried that some people won't be able to get over the ick factor. Eric Luzniak from Santa Rosa, California, could only chuckle.
Anyone who gardens uses manure, and I think most people know what manure is made out of.
If we say something that makes you chuckle or groan or give out any other audible comment, write to us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan is out and about today. He's off on a listening tour to see what parents, teachers, and students have to say about No Child Left Behind. President Obama has said he wants to make some changes to the Bush-era education law. Students who are about to leave high school behind still have some work to do before they can head off to college in the fall, such as figuring out how to pay for it. Policymakers in Pennsylvania are looking for a new way to lower the cost of higher education. Joel Rose reports from Philadelphia.
I'm standing on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, where a construction crew builds what will eventually be a $14 million fitness center and weight room. These are exactly the kind of perks that prospective students have come to expect, even as tuition bills keep getting bigger.
Somewhere in this educational landscape, there should be a no-frills model.
Joe Torsella is chairman of the Pennsylvania State Board of Education. He says the board is worried that college is becoming too expensive for too many families. So earlier this year, the board recommended that Pennsylvania consider creating a different kind of school, one where you can get a decent education for about $10,000 a year in tuition.
There ought to be this option, and we ought to, in the spirit of experimentation, see if there is a market for it.
The no-frills model is already popular in Europe, where it's common for students to live with their parents during college, and there are signs it could work here, too. Richard Vetter directs the Center for College Affordability and Productivity in Washington. Vetter says enrollment is up at community colleges and at for-profit institutions like the University of Phoenix.
They are pretty much no-frill universities. They are
in office buildings, usually near the freeway with good parking. And these schools are growing very rapidly. So that suggests that perhaps the Pennsylvania experiment might work.
That experiment is still in the planning stages, but four-year schools in other parts of the country are already testing out a low-cost approach. The sticker price at Southern New Hampshire University is $35,000 a year. Commuter students in the school's new pilot program pay less than a third of that, but they're still getting the same education, says University President Paul LeBlanc.
So for them, the ability to take all their classes in the morning, to be able to work, to live at home, was really the most important. What they wanted was the academic experience. What they were less interested in were things like fitness centers and food courts.
LeBlanc says those extras drive up the cost of college for everyone. It might seem crazy for prospective students to put so much emphasis on things that don't improve the actual education they're getting, but some economists say it's perfectly rational.
This is all essentially about investing in a good reputation.
Economist and consultant Charles Hatcher says students are trying to send a signal to prospective employers that they are the best of the best.
Students have to do it by going to a reputable school, and then schools have to signal to prospective students that they're that sort of university. And climbing walls or fancy dorm rooms might actually be ways to do that.
When it comes to college, Hatcher says there will always be some consumers who equate price with quality. But Joe Torsella at the Pennsylvania State Board of Education thinks the downturn is starting to chip away at that perception.
There are clearly students who don't want those amenities. We heard from them, and there certainly seems like there's enough of them to support one institution that goes in that direction.
Torsella doesn't expect Pennsylvania to break ground on a new university anytime soon, but he does hope that an existing school finds a way to offer four-year degrees without the bells and whistles. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, courtesy of the Securities and Exchange Commission. This might not be as much of a priority for some now that the market trend line is up. But SEC Chairwoman Mary Shapiro is promising new rules about short selling, that is, buying a stock, betting it's going to go down. Depending on who you talk to, short sellers really helped push the major indices down last fall. Shapiro says the SEC is going to look at that question long and hard, but right now there's no real evidence that that actually happened. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today the Dow dropped 16 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 fell 3 points, 0.4%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, investors deal with their own anxiety in advance of the bank's stress test that we are going to get on Thursday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.